Like going back 100 years, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. What is it like with no communications in storm-ravaged Puerto Rico?
We're going back 100 years where you literally had to walk to your neighbor's house and a police station to know what was happening.
There are shortages of food, water, fuel, even cash is running out on the island.
It's not just a matter of rebuilding a few homes. I mean, this is a complete rebuilding of an entire island.
And there are lots of questions about an old U.S. law that restricts how aid is delivered to Puerto Rico.
Everything has to come through the United States. And people in Puerto Rico are very upset about this because they say that the aid is not arriving.
We focus on the crisis in Puerto Rico today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thank you for being with us today. We're hearing lots of stories out of Puerto Rico. Hurricanes Irma and Maria have left the island in chaos. President Trump insists that emergency supplies are getting through and that his administration is getting great reviews for its handling of the crisis. But just listen to the mayor of San Juan.
We are not on the brink. We are in a humanitarian crisis.
A humanitarian crisis. That is how Carmen Yulín Cruz described things today. She said the lack of diesel fuel was causing major problems, especially at hospitals.
No diesel means no life support systems. People that are dependent on diesel in order to breathe are running out of diesel or their batteries are running out. So they're really fighting life or death situations.
Seeing it all firsthand is Laura Moscoso. Laura is a reporter based in San Juan.
We are going back in time. We are going back 100 years where you literally had to walk to your family's house and to your neighbor's house and to a police station to know what's happening. And calling a friend or calling a family member 3 hours away from our house doesn't exist anymore. So the government has this kind of runners that go around the island and visit the different municipalities to get in touch with the people and the communities. And then they come back to San Juan and give a report. So that task is taking a day, 2 days. So everything is very slow.
Yeah, it is extraordinary. As you say, we're back 100 years ago in terms of technology. But you're obviously on the line with us. Does that suggest that the situation has improved a little bit?
No, that suggests that I have to come from my house to the government operational system, which is the only place in the metropolitan area that has internet connection, that has signal for the telephone. And I live very close to convention center, so I'm walking here because I don't have access to gas either.
How wide has the whole electrical blackout affected things? Because there's refrigeration that stops, but we also forget about like the chaos that results at traffic lights.
Well, there's the hospital need electricity and power to function, and right now there's only 20 hospitals that are fully functioning
on the whole island.
Yeah. And the hospital in San Juan right now has, the power came back for a day or two, and then it was shut down. And right now is at its most capacity. It cannot have any more income patients. So even though it's functioning, you know, in a sense, it's somewhat paralyzed. Without diesel, you cannot have the generators working.
Right. So that diesel comes in by sea. Have you been to the port of San Juan, and what have you seen there? How are they faring?
It's a restricted area right now, and many federal agents are taking care of that situation. What we do know is that the government is saying that, yes, there are many supplies. We do have the diesel. We do have the gasoline. We do have the food. We do have the water. But what we see in the streets is actually people desperate because there are no supplies in the supermarket.
Yeah, a serious disconnect. So, Laura, we're about to hear more about recovery assistance coming from Washington to Puerto Rico. What is Washington doing to help so far?
I know that the president, Donald Trump, said that he was coming here to Puerto Rico next week I think next Tuesday. For me, I'm not sure what he's going to do here, because the main question in my mind is how many security officials and how many security measures are going to go into play for the president's safety when we in Puerto Rico have a security crisis. We even have an official curfew, and people cannot go outside their home after 7 p.m. because there are a lot of robberies, a lot of assaults. Many people take advantages for looting. And so if he comes here, there's like a distraction in the security measures that need to be done for the people of Puerto Rico that live here and are dealing with this crisis.
That is The View from the Ground in Puerto Rico. That was journalist Laura Moscoso in San Juan. In Washington, President Trump says, given the challenges, things are going well. But there's also no doubt that FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is up against a huge challenge right now. Here's The World's Matthew Bell.
Ezequiel Rodriguez Andino is a local radio producer in the capital, San Juan. He spoke with me over an internet connection this morning, and he says it feels like people in Puerto Rico are only beginning to understand the extent of the devastation.
The whole island has been affected. Every single town has been affected in some way. And the communication problem is one of the worst we have ever experienced. I mean, we couldn't even call or text or even look at the internet for at least for 4 days.
Rodriguez Andino says there are some signs that help is on the way. He's seen things like aid trucks on the roads and more planes flying in and out of the airport. But there's a long way to go before this recovery effort gets up to speed. In the meantime, FEMA's got plenty to do. It's busy delivering food, drinking water, tarps, and roofing materials. The federal agency is supposed to respond to disasters in a U.S. territory, such as Puerto Rico, the same way it does in any of the 50 states. But there are some special challenges here. Samantha Montano is an emergency management expert, and she spoke with me from Maine. She says President Trump had a point when he said yesterday that getting help to an island hit by a hurricane makes everything more difficult. Then, Montano says, there's the sheer amount of destruction caused by Hurricane Maria.
When you're looking especially at how the larger systems have been affected, the water systems, the infrastructure, the entire electric grid almost, the rippling effects of that, it's not just a matter of rebuilding a few homes. I mean, this is a complete rebuilding of an entire island of 3.4 million people. I mean, it's kind of difficult to wrap your head around, honestly.
The first phase of emergency response in Puerto Rico is underway, and the focus is on saving lives and keeping people safe. Montano says it's important to listen to what people on the ground are saying, and some in Puerto Rico are criticizing FEMA for being too slow. But Montano adds that it's too early to judge the overall recovery effort just yet.
We're still very much in the middle of this. FEMA does have people in Puerto Rico. They are bringing resources in. But FEMA being in Puerto Rico is not the same thing as people's needs being met.
Montano says the needs people have right now are astronomical. And that's just in the short term.
We're talking about a decade or more long recovery process. And they're going to need significant financial support from the federal government to even begin to think about recovery. Obviously, they were already in a difficult financial situation going into this, and Maria has only made that 10 times more severe.
FEMA is only part of the federal emergency response in Puerto Rico. The U.S. National Guard, the Pentagon, the Coast Guard, and other agencies are involved. Beyond that, Montano says there is a whole informal network of groups that play an important role in any recovery effort. These are the local organizations, charities, and NGOs. But because the hurricane devastated the island's roads and so much else, she says this recovery network is going to need more time to get up and running, too. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
Many of us were lucky to find ourselves out of the path of Hurricane Maria, but we are also wondering how best to help. Dr. Francis Colon is the CEO and founder of the nonprofit Senadores PR, a group of Puerto Rican professionals living in the U.S. They've been providing updates about relief efforts on social media. Dr. Colon, what kind of donations are most needed in Puerto Rico right now, money or things?
We need both of those, and obviously monetary donations are always better. There's been an outpouring of donations of supplies, and those are great. But right now, most of those donations are sort of stuck in the ports. There's very little of distribution systems set up because of the dire situation on the ground. So monetary donations that will lift the organizations that are going to get the island back on its feet post-immediate rescue and relief are very important right now.
And what organizations do you suggest people donate to?
Hispanics in Philanthropy, HIP, has launched a fund of vetted organizations. Ford Foundation and others went through the process of vetting all of those civil society organizations on the ground. So they have a good fund set up that will disperse money that those smaller organizations in Puerto Rico can take to rebuild in the aftermath.
And tell us the name again.
Hispanics in Philanthropy, HIP.
Good thing that they're vetting, because there's always concern about how donations are used. How has the vetting process gone?
Well, Ford Foundation and others had been vetting organizations prior to the hurricane to help Puerto Rico with its economic crisis. So we're now being able to take advantage of that process to know that these organizations are legit and that they have the full support of foundations here in the United States and the mainland.
I know your organization, Senadores, has also been calling on the federal government to do more. Can you just tell us about that? Like, how can people help the federal government do more?
Absolutely. We've seen a federal government response in the middle of this crisis that at this time is unfortunately inadequate for the scale of the need and the devastation. FEMA is down there. Other government agencies are down there. But supplies are stuck in the ports. They don't have the distribution capacity right now to the entire island. We're talking about drivers for fuel trucks and drivers to take supplies to the stores that will give supplies to the people. That is pretty much at a very slow point right now, and people are desperate. We need fuel to reach hospitals, senior centers, to keep food, insulin, refrigerated. We need the response to be much greater, which is why we've been activating U.S. citizens across the country to call on their congressmen, to call on the federal government, to give the word that FEMA needs to allow boots on the ground from National Guards across the United States immediately, because the need is great.
Given what you know, what we know, what we've all heard and seen from the island, what do you think of President Trump's comment that FEMA is doing a great job?
FEMA is doing what it's been told to do up to this point. I think the president needs to step up and take ownership of this and tell FEMA, give the order for mission to be greatly increased, double, triple what they're doing right now.
Francis, do you have family in Puerto Rico yourself? And if so, how are they doing?
My mother is there. She's 68 years old. And I talked to her this morning. She said, I'm running out of fuel. I'm running out of food, too. I'm just desperately trying to get her out. At this point, we've bought a ticket for Monday to get her out. That was the earliest we could find a ticket available. And now I'm just trying to get her through the next few days. But the situation at the airport is also dismal. Hundreds of people at the airport trying to get out, people sleeping there for days, running out of food at the airport, and the cash machines are empty. So this is dire.
Dr. Francis Colon is the CEO and founder of the nonprofit Senadores PR. Dr. Colon, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Just ahead, what is the Jones Act and why are so many people in Puerto Rico upset about it? You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Fat, buttery words.
About language.
Sniggly, chuckling words.
The world in words.
Wormy, squirmy, mealy words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We've been talking Puerto Rico on the show today. The island has been devastated, as you know, by Hurricanes Irma and Maria. Food, water, and fuel are all in short supply. And there is concern that Washington is not moving quickly enough to help, a charge that the Trump administration refutes. In the middle of it all is the Jones Act, a nearly century-old law that places restrictions on how food, fuel, and other hurricane relief supplies get to the island. For more on this, we have Yarimar Bonilla on the line with us. She's a professor of anthropology and Caribbean Studies at Rutgers University. We'll get to the Jones Act in a moment, Yarimar, but first, I gather you've got family in Puerto Rico. Have you been able to reach them, and are they okay?
Yes, I'm very fortunate that I have been able to reach them. All my family is relatively safe and accounted for. You know, they have limited food and water and are waiting for the U.S. to step up its assistance. But for now, they're safe, and I'm very lucky that I can talk to them.
Yeah, we're very glad to hear that, too. That limited food, especially, I mean, we can look at the Jones Act to kind of understand why that's happening. Give us a quick history lesson. What is the Jones Act?
So the Jones Act is a law that was established in the 1920s in the wake of the World War to assure the U.S. Shipping industry and make sure that there would be sufficient boats necessary if another war were to strike. And so what the Jones Act stipulates is that any ships that arrive with goods to a U.S. port, that those are U.S.-made ships flying U.S. flags manned by U.S. citizens or residents. And so that means that anything that is going to arrive to Puerto Rico cannot come directly from another country, that it has to come from another U.S. port. So, for example, right now in the moment of the hurricane, if the Dominican Republic wanted to send us food and any kind of assistance, a ship from the Dominican Republic couldn't come directly from Puerto Rico. It would have to go to Jacksonville, Florida. And from there, the goods would have to be unloaded, put onto an American ship that was manned by a U.S. crew, and then it could come to Puerto Rico.
Right. So that makes life very complicated to get stuff directly and quickly to Puerto Rico.
It absolutely does.
Now, yesterday, the Trump administration seemed to signal it would not issue a temporary waiver to the Jones Act. But after a lot of backlash, it appears it's now reconsidering all of this. Historically, how has the U.S. government dealt with these waiver requests? Have they ever issued them?
Well, just recently, legislation was lifted in the case of Irma for Texas in order to be able to have oil to fuel the pipelines. So clearly, the supplying the oil pipelines has been given more urgency than bringing food and aid to Puerto Rico. People in Puerto Rico are very upset about this because they say that the aid is not arriving. And so they do feel like that we need this assistance from the government.
Do you know what the rationale is in Washington right now to not waive it?
I have no idea. When the law was put into place, the rationale was to make sure that the U.S. had a strong shipping industry so that it had a strong merchant marine in the case of another war. Right now, most battles are not fought through the merchant marine, right? We have other technology. So I don't know why the U.S. is clinging to this legislation, other than perhaps it is economically beneficial to those who then are able to benefit from the limited trade that Puerto Rico can have.
Yeah, I mean, many have pointed to the Jones Act as a sign of, you know, problematic relationship between the U.S. and Puerto Rico, a sign of colonial control that still remains. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, because people in Puerto Rico, they aren't able to dictate the terms of their economic relationships and their engagements with the world. Everything has to come through the United States. And it also forces Puerto Rico to be a protected market for U.S. goods. And so it's no coincidence that in Puerto Rico, you have the largest number of Walmarts and Walgreens per square foot than anywhere in the world. It's because these are kind of captive consumers for these U.S. companies.
If the Jones Act is not repealed or not waived for the indefinite future, it also seems rebuilding the island could be extremely expensive, difficult, and maybe even impossible. Do you think that's the case?
Well, I want to think it's not impossible, although, you know, it absolutely is going to very much hamper the efforts to bring in construction materials, for example. These are things that have to be brought by ship.
Yarimar Bonilla at Rutgers University, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, thank you.
We've been focused on the aftermath of Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico. Meanwhile, on the other side of the world, people are watching a volcano very closely. Scientists say Mount Agung on the island of Bali may erupt at any moment. More than 75,000 people have already been evacuated. Here's more from my BBC colleague, Howell Griffith.
Packed into the Swechapura Sports Center, hundreds of families sit and wait. The children play, some do their schoolwork. After being forced to leave their homes and their livelihoods, there's little more people here can do. The eruption of Mount Agung could be hours, days, or maybe even weeks away. No one here really knows. For Komang, the time seems to be moving slowly.
I'm bored spending days and days here. At home I can work. I have my cows and chickens to take care of. It hurts that my house has been abandoned.
Others like Kadek are already thinking about what happens next.
It will be tough if my house is destroyed and I have to rebuild it.
However huge the threat, what you notice is that people are pretty calm. Most understand the need to be out of harm's way. And everyone knows when the volcano last erupted in 1963, it took more than 1,000 lives. In Bali, Mount Agung is seen as a sacred site. Many Balinese face towards it as they pray. And so whatever comes in the next few days is seen to be in the lap of the gods. While most of the 7-mile exclusion zone around the volcano has been evacuated, a few people have been holding out, waiting, it's said, for a spiritual sign. Those looking for more scientific warnings say the rate of seismic activity has been intense, with hundreds of tremors being recorded every day. The 1963 eruption saw ash and gas being launched 10,000 metres into the sky. If that were to happen again, it could have a lasting impact across Bali. For now, flights into Denpasar Airport have been continuing more or less as normal. Some airlines are choosing to carry extra fuel in case they arrive to find they can't land. But a cloud of volcanic ash would close the skies completely and shut down Bali's biggest industry, tourism. But visitors arriving yesterday seemed quite relaxed about the prospect of being marooned here.
The company that have booked it through haven't advised, you know, any warnings. They've obviously advised that the volcano might erupt, but as long as I'm away from it over a certain kilometre, I don't think I'll be going that close to that area.
Help has started to arrive for the 75,000 Balinese already displaced in emergency centres like this one. Convoys of rice, noodles, face masks too. The Indonesian President Joko Widodo has vowed to lessen the economic impact. But faced with the destructive force of nature, there's little he or anyone else can do but wait.
The BBC's Howell Griffith there, reporting from Bali.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Nobody here likes paying taxes, and the IRS doesn't get a ton of respect. Not so with tax collectors in other countries.
They have blazers, they have baseball caps, they have bands, they have mascots. People are proud to work in the tax agency because people respect their work.
A global look at taxes and the people who collect them. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Big news from our Across Women's Lives desk today. Saudi Arabia is signaling a breakthrough on women's rights. For the first time, a Saudi woman has been named to a senior government post. And as you may have heard by now, the king has issued a decree allowing women to drive. Advocates are welcoming the move, but critics caution that the Saudi government remains a repressive regime. Still, Saudi women are celebrating big time. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari.
If you want to know how frustrating the driving ban is for some women in Saudi Arabia, just picture this. You wake up in the morning, you need that coffee so bad. You head to the kitchen, and there's no milk.
And the keys are sitting right there on the table.
But you're a woman, so you can't drive.
And it'd be this elaborate coordination of calling multiple people, trying to find the driver. No, the driver's asleep. Driver went off to pray. We can't find him. And then just, you know, hours just to move short distances.
Leila Hariri is a Saudi-American novelist. She was born to an American mother and a Saudi father. She grew up in Saudi Arabia and later left to study abroad. The driving ban, she says, was the main reason she could not imagine returning to live in the city she grew up in and loves.
And it was just very artificially handicapped. And I just couldn't imagine living like that continuously.
Women in Saudi Arabia have been fighting the driving ban since the 1990s. They've challenged it in different ways. This is activist Lujain Al-Hathloul. taken to the road in 2013. After she posted this video online, the harassment began. She was arrested. Her passport was taken away. Over the years, others have lost their jobs and have been shunned by society. And then, yesterday, came this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The Saudi representative at the United Nations made the announcement no one was expecting.
You may be interested to know that a few minutes ago, a royal decree has been issued in Saudi Arabia giving women the right to drive.
I was in shock. I was very surprised. I thought maybe it would happen in 10 years or like 15 years, but not now.
Nadia Malika thought it was a hoax at first. She was at her home in the city of Jeddah in Saudi Arabia. Friends began messaging her, and slowly it started to sink in.
Like, so many different things are going to happen now due to this law. And I'm just very curious to see the details of them allowing us to drive.
Malika tells me she's lucky to be able to afford a personal driver. And to be honest, she likes it.
I find driving a hassle. The streets are crowded, parking. I love the fact that I can just go up to the store, get dropped off at the door, and then have the driver worry about parking. I take a nap after work in the car on the way back home. So for me, this is like relaxing time.
But she knows others aren't as lucky. Besides, she says, it's about having the right to choose. When I ask Leila Hariri, the Saudi American novelist, why she thinks the ban was lifted now, she points to the economics of all this. A lot of the drivers in Saudi come from places like the Philippines or Bangladesh, and they send part of their salaries to families back home, money that Saudi Arabia loses.
You know, so if you have that 5,000 rial income, instead of 5,000 going to a driver who immediately, you know, kind of wires it all to Philippines, you know, have that $500 spent within the country instead.
Woman behind the wheels means more women buying cars. Malika, the woman I reached in Jeddah, says her friends are already thinking about what cars they're going to drive, even though the ban is not going to be lifted until next summer.
I don't know. I'm hearing Mercedes. I'm hearing Bentleys. Very expensive cars. So you can tell what kind of friends I have.
Malika doesn't see this as an end to the struggle for human rights in Saudi Arabia. On the contrary, she says, this is just the beginning.
It's not specifically the driving that I'm excited about. I'm excited about the possibilities of what's going to come after this. Because this is a huge step for the country that has been fighting this for a very, very long time.
As for her driver, she'll keep him. That afternoon nap is oh so hard to give up. For the world, Shirin Jafari.
Here's another story from our Across Women's Lives desk. Between Harvey, Irma, and Maria, it has been a tough month for folks in the Caribbean and the American South. The hurricanes affected everyone in their paths. They also underscored deep social divides. The horrific weather made it clear that in an increasingly mobile world, not everyone is mobile. Not everyone gets to escape the storm in time, and not everyone gets to come back. We sent the world's Jasmine Garz to Texas in the wake of Hurricane Harvey. Here's the first of three stories she'll have for us in the coming days.
First, it rained bullets in a town somewhere in Texas. That's how Anne describes her husband's final fit of rage.
Maki's father shot my house up, trying to kill me.
I can't tell you Anne's last name. She's still in danger. But I can tell you that she was lucky.
Neither one of us, not one bullet touched us.
Anne took her kids and came here to a domestic violence shelter in the city of Beaumont. It's the only shelter in six counties. A few days after she arrived, it started raining again. This time, it was Hurricane Harvey.
Me and my four children, when we woke up, we stepped in water. And then we looked out the window, and it was just water. And it was just steady coming in. And so me, I tried to like get the towels thinking and hoping maybe just our little area. It wasn't. It was the whole wing.
The whole wing was flooded. Anne started to panic. She watched people on television evacuating, and she says she thought, well, maybe it's time to go back home.
And so I'm sitting there, I'm thinking to myself, oh, wow, what am I going to do? Your choices are, do I go back to my abuser and deal with some stuff, or try to figure out, you know, because you have no money because, you know, you're just in a bad place.
And deep down inside, she knew. She knew exactly how the story would end if she went back.
I mean, if he's pretty much telling me, I'm going to kill you.
Expected to be a Category 3 when it hits.
Urgent warnings going out, evacuations underway at this hour, flights already being canceled.
For women in Anne's situation, women who are already fleeing, evacuating during a natural disaster.
It's very complicated because a lot of our women cut ties with their families, cut ties with their friends.
Deborah Tomov is the director at the Beaumont shelter, and she says taking these women to public shelters is risky.
It's a small community, so if you're running away from your abuser, it's very, you know, the concern is that, you know, your abuser can find you in a place like that where everybody is just there in one place.
Tomov had to think quickly. The water was too high for them to drive the women, so the fire department had to take them to the civic center. The Beaumont shelter was damaged, so the authorities took the women to Dallas, where they stayed for a couple of weeks.
I just kept telling me, just look at it as an adventure.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Let's get straight to the breaking news. Harvey provoking an unfolding flooding disaster in America's fourth largest city, Houston, Texas.
About 80 miles south in parts of Houston, the damage from Harvey is extensive. As I drive down one of the main avenues, rows of little houses stare back blankly, their insides spilled on the sidewalks. Soggy couches, tables, chairs. But amidst the devastation, I find another domestic violence shelter. This one is called Bridge Over Troubled Waters, which remains unscathed.
Category 5 hurricane. This building was built to withstand a Category 5 hurricane.
Debbie Mosley is the executive director of this shelter. She smiles proudly as she pats the thick brick wall. During the storm, they had trouble with the phones.
But we did get a call from the police department the night of the storm, and there was a sexual assault. The night of the storm, there was a rape.
And she came here.
The shelter stood strong. But Mosley tells me a lot of these women still lost what little they had. And for them, it's going to be an especially uphill battle to rebuild. We keep walking through the shelter. I meet a woman named Ashley in the hallway.
I never expected to be in this situation. You know, I've always had a family and a home and my children as well.
Ashley sits down next to me on a bench under a fluorescent light and strokes her pregnant belly. She won't go into detail. She refers to what her husband did to her as the incident.
When the incident happened, I just had no choice but to take off. I really don't have anybody, so this is the first time that I'm really having to just do it on my own.
She says she's lucky the shelter was built strong enough to withstand the storm. Still, she worries about what's next. She's on a waiting list to receive housing. But after Hurricane Harvey, as many as 40,000 homes have been lost. She worries she's no longer a priority, and she gets it.
These people out there have lost, I can't imagine, just out of nowhere losing your home and your life is together and you're just stranded with your family.
Ashley pauses and laughs sadly.
I mean, I can imagine, yes.
For The World, I'm Jasmine Garst, Houston, Texas.
Historic tax relief for the American people. That's what President Trump promised today at a speech in Indiana.
We're going to cut taxes for the middle class, make the tax code simpler and more fair for everyday Americans.
Author and journalist T.R. Reid spent a year traveling around the world to see how other people pay taxes. He watched enviously as his Dutch friend Michael filed his returns.
He pops a beer. He goes online. He looks at the form that the government has filled out because the government knows all the numbers, just like the IRS knows all the numbers.
Wow.
They fill out the form. If it looks right, you check OK and you're done in 5 minutes.
But T.R. Reid's Dutch friend is still a bit skeptical.
Michael says to me, he says, I'm what you guys would call a Republican. I don't trust government. So, you know, I start checking the numbers. And now he's getting really mad. He says, you know, sometimes you start checking the numbers, it can take 15, 20 minutes just to pay your taxes, he says. He was ticked off.
Wow.
Average American family, according to the IRS, a family at the median income of $56,000 spends 13 hours a year gathering the data and filling out forms and an average of $370 paying somebody to do it for them. In other countries, it's a matter of minutes and it costs nothing. And the really striking thing, Marco, we could do that too.
In Japan, a country you know quite well, how does the tax system work there?
Their tax day is April 1st, and the government sends you a postcard in early March. says, we think you earned this much. We withheld this much. We owe you X amount in refund. We'll put it in your bank account on April 1st. And if that looks right to you, you do nothing. You file the card away. If you don't like their numbers, then you go into the tax office.
So in comparison, the American tax system is really way more complex. Let's just talk about the tax rate compared to other countries. TR, let me give you a quick audio quiz. It is true or false, and it's in response to this.
We have the highest tax rate anywhere in the world, and our middle class is being absolutely destroyed.
Was Donald Trump on the campaign trail last year. T.R. Reid, is the president accurate? Do Americans pay the highest tax rate of any place in the world?
No, Marco, that's an alternative fact. You take all the state, local, federal, liquor, gas, et cetera, taxes that everybody pays as a percentage of GDP, of total wealth. And by that standard, guess what? Of the 35 richest countries, the U.S. ranks 33rd. In total tax burden. We're undertaxed. We pay less in income tax and Social Security tax, tobacco tax in other countries. Where the president has a point is the corporate tax rate. Our corporate tax rate is higher than our competing countries. And that's one of the things the Republicans are talking about doing. I think the Democrats agree. Reduce the corporate tax rate somewhat. And maybe that would reduce the incentive for American companies to move their profits overseas.
Do corporations actually pay those taxes in the long run? And aren't those corporate taxes also offset by massive opportunities for write-offs?
Yeah, any company that paid the 35% rate would fire its chief financial officer the next morning. Nobody pays the full rate. But even if you take the effective rate, that is the amount companies actually pay, which averages around 16 to 18%, that's higher than in most of our competing countries. So all the other countries reduced their corporate taxes in this century, and America did not. So that's something we ought to do. And the way you pay for it is you take away some of the hundreds and hundreds of giveaways that have been added to the tax code for specific companies. They write a whole section of the law that helps, and they never say what the name of the company is. They say, for any company that was incorporated in Delaware on October 13th, 1916. Well, that's General Motors, but they never say it. And the tax code is full of those. And I will say that the Republican plan released today, it says we're going to lower tax rates by taking away exemptions and deductions. The only flaw is they don't say which exemptions and deductions they're going to take away. And that's where the fight's going to come.
It seems like you can go all the way back to Benjamin Franklin and his line, the only two things that are certain in life are death and taxes. And since then, it seems Americans just don't have a good word to say about taxes. But other countries, it's kind of the opposite, isn't it? I mean, you write, in fact, that in Japan, one of the most beloved movies is about a charming but tenacious tax auditor.
Yeah, Marumoto Nobuko. She's kind of the Meg Ryan of Japan. And in this movie, a taxing woman, or audit bureau woman is what it's called, she goes after the biggest tax cheat in Japan and follows his Rolls Royce around on her little red scooter. And in the end, she finds the document that will send this tax cheat to jail, and the whole audience cheers. Can you imagine us casting Meg Ryan as a tax auditor? I don't think so. But in other countries, the tax bureau, nobody likes paying taxes, but the tax bureau in other countries is a highly respected organization. They have blazers, they have baseball caps, they have bands, they have mascots. People are proud to work in the tax agency because people respect their work. In the United States, the IRS recommends that its employees not tell people where they work. Just say, I'm a federal employee.
Yeah. T.R. Reid's latest book is A Fine Mess, A Global Quest for a Simpler, Fairer, and More Efficient Tax System. Thanks for being with us, T.R.
Great to be on your air again, Marco. Thanks.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World.
I was walking on one cloudy morning with a certain shadow on my soul. Underneath a shadow that was yearning, beat on walking on the burning coal.
New music from the band Gogol Bordello. Singing there is frontman Eugene Hoots. Born in Ukraine, left with his family for many reasons, not the least of which was the danger of radiation from the Chernobyl nuclear meltdown in 1986. We'll hear more music from the band and hear Hoots' thoughts about identity and Ukraine in just a minute. Here's a short news item, though, from Ukraine that nicely sets up my chat with Eugene Hoots, because it tells us something about Ukrainian identity. Earlier this month, Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko signed a bill that makes Ukrainian the official language in public schools for grades 5 and up. Poroshenko says the law will help kids get a leg up when looking for jobs in Ukraine. But minorities in Ukraine don't see it that way, and they don't want an official state language. Critics of the law say that mandating one language in the school system threatens people who speak Polish, Hungarian, or Russian. Russia has already stated that it's not happy with the law, and the government in Hungary has even threatened to block Ukraine's push for membership in the European Union. So, Ukraine trying to assert its identity while others sense a loss of identity and now seeing a struggle to fit in. That leads us back to Eugene Hoots, the lead singer of Gogol Bordello. He's often struggled to fit in, came to America from Ukraine, created a band in New York City that made a big impact, but then he split for Rio de Janeiro.
Basically, I went there for a carnival and then came home 7 years later.
You never left. You went to carnival, so like 2010, 11 or something like that?
2008.
2008.
Yeah, so. I mean, then I went to Argentina for another year after Brazil.
Right. Eugene Hoots joined us in our studios recently. I wanted to ask him about the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. That battle began 2.5 years ago. It led to the Russian annexation of Crimea and ongoing battles in the eastern part of the country.
I am not really particularly inspired by this conflict. I mean, it's just like, I find it to be really absurd and depressing. The entanglement there is just, there is no end to that conversation. You know, I was kind of always pretty much aware that this is a very old land. It's already sort of set in its way. And it's going to kind of dwell in its old problems forever. Nothing is going to get resolved.
Yeah.
And Soviet Union, it was already kind of a disaster. So, you know, perhaps it's better to just do your best to, you know, align yourself with something more futuristic. I just not the person who dwells in an old, problems.
I'm wondering if you take that kind of attitude because you're not living there anymore. You're living here. When you talk with your contemporaries back in Kiev on the phone, do they feel the same way?
A lot of them feel, of course, very patriotic.
Do you feel patriotic?
On a level, on a tribal level, maybe, and on a cultural level. But I also know that Ukraine has been sort of diluted to a certain extent throughout Soviet era.
Now, that point is an important one that many Ukrainians agree with. Their culture and identity got subsumed by Russia during the Soviet era, and that aftertaste has lasted in Ukraine to this day. Here's Eugene Hoots again.
I always felt like I'm some sort of a observer, even when I was inside of it. You know, I never felt like I quite made it into the league of real Ukrainian this or real Ukrainian that, and I certainly didn't feel Russian.
Yeah.
I just felt like I was somehow misplaced to begin with. One of my friends actually put it pretty well when I was leaving, that he was like, yeah, you know, you never really fit the local streets. You gotta go, man. You
know, was that a compliment or was that an insult?
Neither. It was just kind of how it is.
Yeah. So you've got this interesting kind of foot in Ukraine, U.S. and Latin America, and you never really felt totally Ukrainian and resettled in the U.S. I'm just curious to know what thoughts occur to you in this strange age of anti-immigrant feeling in Washington and everything that's been going on. The U.S. used to be this open country. It feels a lot less open now. What do you see?
I know I get asked a lot of this suddenly, and something came to my attention. It was a book, autobiography of this Swedish prime minister during World War One and World War Two. And he himself was just very much activist, going on missions to like Africa and Latin America, and very involved with supporting, you know, the suffering people. Like, that was his background, right? In his autobiography, there was not a one single mention of World War One, World War Two, or any of his missions.
That's odd.
It's odd, but. And I found it to be incredibly interesting because clearly that person was involved in social justice on all fronts. Did he brag about it? No. So I find something for myself in that.
And what is that? Sum it up.
Well, I mean, I just find a lot of people kind of jumping on a wagon of being rebellious when it's the most convenient thing to do.
Yeah.
It's just like, that is so lame.
That kind of...
So how about, like, where were you like 10, 15, 20, and then 30, 40 years ago? You know, and where will you be 5 years from now?
So Eugene Hoots is suspicious of anyone who jumps on the bandwagon with a song that feels like activism and self-righteous chest-thumping. But he and Gogol Bordello don't shy away from the immigrant and refugee issue here in the U.S. On their just-released album, there's a track called...
You Know Who We Are? It's more about just keeping a high frequency while it's happening, after it's happening, and hopefully before it was happening.
Kind of a situational awareness.
Yes, that's actually a good way to put it.
Fire hose in your ear, blow torch in your face. We live behind the kingdom of disgrace. Whatever happened to being transmuted, you find out quick when being uprooted. Hey guys, you stuck in a rooted funk. With immigrants dying, I transmute your junk. Ain't no gypsy, cry superstar. With immigrants dying, you know who we are.
Eugene Hoots, band leader of Gogol Bordello. Their new album is Seekers and Finders, and they are already on their fall world tour. The show is as high energy as always. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
Statue of Liberty, I watch you go in and out of dust. And sometimes all ships that ever came through here come out at me all at once. Nuestros ojos luminosos en espera de un nuevo día. Aunque hayan días grises, sirve el viento en compañía. No hay que temblar.
PRI, Public Radio International.